Hi, I'm Alex Roman, executive editor for Metro Magazine, and welcome to Metrospectives. My guest today is Scott Bogren, executive director of the Community Transportation Association of America, or CTAA. Today, Scott joins me to discuss the unique challenges facing CTAA membership, how membership is emerging from COVID, and much more. Hey, Scott, thanks for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You?
I'm doing great, thanks. I don't know if you remember, I was thinking the other day, when the pandemic hit, we decided to start a podcast. And when we started that podcast, I think you were one of the first two or three people that we had on. Do you remember kind of those heady times at that moment?
Isn't it strange how like that whole pandemic period is just this black hole of time that we all kind of managed? And now I think back and I get to a point in time and it's hard to pick a frame of reference. I'm like, oh, that was during the pandemic. Ah, that makes sense.
Right.
But I've done a lot of podcasts. And so, and I think I do remember though, cause I obviously, there was not a lot going on at that time.
Right. And I remember it sticks out in my mind because, I think I've mentioned this before here on the video cast, but at the time, we were both trying to, me and my wife were trying to kind of both working parents and everything. And it was early in the morning. I had nowhere else to go. So I think I recorded our podcast in my car with some headphones and a microphone and my laptop in my lap. So I think that's why.
Well, as long as you didn't ask me to sing, then I think we'd be okay. Yeah.
So again, thanks for joining me. I think I want to just talk, you know, just in case somebody's not familiar with what CTAA does, can you give me a little background about what it is you guys do and who you represent?
Sure. We're a 30 plus year old organization that represents and advocates and does training and resources and all sorts of things for smaller transit agencies. Our core from the beginning was rural, which is, they used to call them non-urbanized areas. We right. Now actually, but the population under 50,000 is a UZA. We do a lot of work now with smaller cities up to about 200,000. We've got a lot of members that are tribes or that are doing kind of specialized or NEMT services. All those folks work with us and hopefully find relevance in being a member of our organization.
And since you're dealing with you know, kind of these smaller agencies and people maybe where the funding isn't as the dollar amounts aren't quite as high, what are some of the kind of the unique challenges that they're dealing with?
Well, it's been interesting. The for the last 6 months, year, for the first time in my career, I've been with CTAA coming up on 35 years. It's the first time I've really had people kind of saying, I'd like you to really aggressively advocate for issues beyond just more money. Right. They're not like saying we don't need resources, because they do. But I think some of the regulatory reform that they'd like to see and some of the issues that they're dealing with when it comes to buying buses or smaller vehicles, hiring drivers, have moved up the priority list above the funding issue. And I honestly think that's the first time I've seen that in my career.
35 years. So you started there when you were 15?
You're too kind. I did start there. I did start here young. But yeah, 35 years. And when we bring on new staff, I can always tell them that it's almost a guarantee that I did your job at some point in time. And right. I will never ask anybody here to do something that I didn't already do. The danger is bringing people on who have way better ideas than I had when I held that job and not trying to slow them down by saying, well, I tried that and it didn't work, and actually letting them, because oftentimes they prove me wrong.
Yeah. That I often find myself doing that myself. It's just like, oh, I That didn't work for me, but I guess I shouldn't voice that because maybe it works now. You don't know.
Yeah, it is like an initial reaction from a management standpoint that you really've got to curtail and kind of not do that, because I think for our staff, we've got really quality people here and they're going to take different approaches than I did, and the conditions are different. And to a certain extent too, you've got to let people make their own way. And sometimes that means make their own mistakes. I try to say that to the staff, like mistakes that are made in pursuit of things that we believe in are just adjustments. And I don't want people to be afraid of making mistakes because that's how you change things.
Right. And you mentioned procurement, and I know the supply chain, obviously there's a big issue with the larger buses going on, and there's also issues with the smaller and the mid-sized vehicles. Can you talk a little bit about how that's impacting and how it's making it difficult for procurement for your membership?
Oh, well, I mean, the easiest way to say it is it costs at least 50% more for a body on chassis or a cutaway, for an accessible minivan. I mean, the kind of the workhorses, our urban members that are operating 35 and 40 foot buses are now seeing, you know, those types of cost increases for one, and then really lengthy delivery times, 2-3 years. And for smaller agencies, that means probably having to use a vehicle that ought to be out of service and is no longer, quote unquote, in a state of good repair, needing to really get those extra couple of years out of a vehicle that they didn't, which increases their operating costs and other things. So there's certainly that. And I think our members too are clear in telling us that just the overall kind of set of procurement procedures are really designed for agencies that have a whole department that does nothing but that.
Right.
And at a smaller agency, that's the general manager, who's also the procurement manager, and also, and so when I talked about earlier, like about regulatory reform, we don't want, you know, we're not looking to slash regulations. We're just looking to right size some of those and have them be based on smaller agencies' capacity.
That's a good point. And going back to the kind of the vehicle thing, I mean, with an inability to get vehicles 2 or 3 years out, we're talking agencies with very small numbers of vehicles. So you're running, if you need to replace three and you have a fleet of 10, I mean, those are three that you're not being able to utilize fully.
Yeah, smaller agencies, they're great to work with. And I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, they're accessible. They can make change quickly. They are passionate throughout their leadership levels about the work they're doing. They are not very far removed from the customers. They know a lot of the passengers, and all that is real gratifying to work with. The other thing is they're used to operating on really smaller budgets. So if they're going to go out and get a group of vehicles, or if they're going to procure some software, their mentality is like, I'm now committed for the next 10 years to these vehicles. Or, you know, there's not a mentality of like, oh, well, they didn't work. Or that software just doesn't really work, so I need to move on to the next thing. They can't operate like that, and they never have.
Right. And I know that a lot of these smaller agencies and a lot of these rural and agencies and the people you guys represent, I know that their ridership wasn't quite as impacted from COVID as some of the larger cities. But I was wondering, you know, as they kind of emerge from COVID, are they looking at different models for mobility? Have they learned anything new that they can use to kind of adapt the services they have?
Yeah, sure. For the rurals, it's funny, you know, the the industry, the transit industry as a whole, pre-pandemic, maybe because of the advent and the onset of Uber and Lyft, and like discovered on-demand mobility. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks would assert that, you know, that's a brand new concept. And I have members that are like, I've been doing that since the 70s. Like, like that's what we do is on-demand mobility, mobility as a service. Well, absolutely. That's what they've been doing. But look, the software has gotten better. I think the customer facing pieces of the software have really gotten better. And I think you see that, Alex, when you look at like, oh, it used to be, I remember working on, when the ADA was passing way long time ago, in the late 80s, early 90s. And at the time we thought like, wow, a 48 hour advance notice window is like cutting edge. And what the technologies have done, you know, is now to say, no, it needs to be 48 seconds or 4 minutes. And what that does for rural riders, for that, it's truly life-changing. And I often tell people, like, you try to lead your life with a 48 hour lag anytime you want to leave home. And now suddenly you can call and something comes on demand. That's just a major change in your quality of life. So for our rural folks, absolutely, that was what we started to see. Their ridership, you're right, it never plummeted. It ridership reduced, no doubt. And it's come back. The what slowed ridership return in a lot of the rural communities is some of the service trip generators, maybe a congregate meal site for seniors, were slower to reopen because they were fearful of transmission of the virus. And as those have opened, ridership is largely returned. For our small cities, they're kind of scaled down versions of major metros. We had a conference a couple of weeks ago in Mississippi for our fixed route members. Mm-hmm. And we had three who have ridership returned at more than 100% of where they were pre-pandemic. And they all spoke about what they've done. And for them, it's a combination of fare policies, service redesigns, and marketing strategies. If any transit agency, though, that was really reliant on commuters is going to have a challenge right now, because telework is going to be probably one of the most lasting aspects of the pandemic period that we're going to be dealing with. I mean, it's a reality, and it's a challenge to any of those agencies.
Right. Yeah. And I had a couple of questions here left, but kind of going off a script of what I had a little bit, because I'm curious about a couple of things. As far as technology goes, I mean, are these agencies embracing technology a little bit more? Do they have the capacity to test technology a little bit more than maybe they used to in the past?
They are, but you're spot on with a concern about capacity. Mm-hmm. I think that large urban systems understand that data is an important component in their infrastructure. You know, it's an asset.
Right.
The smaller agencies don't get that yet. You know, the data is either something they're forced to do through the NTD that they do, but they don't really like doing it, or that they find it time consuming. They don't see the value in it. So there is kind of a growing digital divide technologically. You're accurate in that assessment.
Right. And then you mentioned I forget how you phrased it, but kind of rethinking fare structure.
Yeah.
Are you talking about making it cheaper, or are you looking at more people kind of looking at the fare-free model?
The three that we're presenting, we're looking at the fairless model, but implementing it in different ways. And nothing good came from the pandemic. And I hate when people say, well, the silver lining, it did give some transit agencies some space to test some things. And because they had to go fare free for a period of time, it was a forced test. But I think some communities said, hey, this is working. We had a manager of a system at the conference a couple of weeks ago say, like, well, I'm already going there. You know, the bus is already going along this route. It's going to do it whether there's somebody on it or not.
And
I think that mentality, but I be careful that we need the fares. And if you're going to go fare free, you better have fully planned out replacing those funds, because, you know, we are still as an industry underinvested in. And when we talk about infrastructure and you know, we don't want to turn our back on an important revenue source as well.
Yeah. Great. Well, I have a couple more, and they happen to be on funding. I guess first, you know, kind of the concerns and the funding approaches for these smaller agencies that CTA represents.
Usually it's a very diverse funding. The smaller you get, kind of the more diverse budgets you see. And these are systems in the rural space that are cobbling together some funds from maybe Medicaid, because they're providing non-emergency medical transportation contract trips. I hope I didn't say this the last podcast, but I've got a lot of rural transit managers who kind of think of themselves as professional beggars. That, you know, they go from a number of small towns in their communities, in their region, and solicit enough to be able to get that non-federal share, because most of these folks don't have like a built-in tax that's providing that. So, and then the larger ones you get, the funding sources kind of start to look more towards federal, state, and local transit funding directly, and they're less likely to be looking at some of these other sources. But, you know, I've literally visited and worked directly with hundreds of transit systems in my career, and I can't ever think of one where I looked at the budget and I said, oh yeah, this is the same as X. They're all a little bit unique.
Yeah. And you mentioned kind of did dedicated sales tax or revenue. I know that larger transit agencies were still, I think, over 80% success with ballot measures. Is that something that would work in these areas, or is that something that just hasn't been tried and is it something that may work? Okay.
Yeah. If you look at that 80% mark you're seeing, you'll see that a lot of those are coming from Michigan, which does millage, which is a property tax for county-based systems. And a lot of those are rural. I mean, you get outside of the Detroit metro area and kind of get north into Michigan, it gets rural real quick. And they support it. So it's the challenge for a lot of rural operators is the initial assessment of a voter that I live in a rural community. And my vision of public transit is the subway system I see on television in New York City. And, well, we don't need that. Right. And trying to have them understand that a right-sized approach that allows people to maintain independence, that can connect people to work, to school, and really can connect regions together. Because that's what we've seen with rural America that's changed over the last two decades during my career, is the catchment area of transit systems in the rural space used to be like a small town. Well, now seven small towns have one community college, one hospital, one major retail area in a whole region. And that rural operator now serves the entirety of that. So it asks them to be a lot more efficient. And so from a support standpoint, like all forms of transit, we're constantly trying to figure out how best to articulate the value, oftentimes to a voter who might not ever use the system until their mother needs to go to dialysis. And then they're like, oh, I get it.
Right.
I have to leave work three times a week. This system's there. Prior to that, maybe they wouldn't have seen or understood the value.
Right. And I think the larger picture of funding, you know, a big infusion of cash with IIJA for transit agencies and a positive step for, like you said, having to beg all the time for funding. Oh,
such a huge step. I mean, I don't even want to think about what would have happened to CTA's members during the pandemic without those funds. Right. It would have been dire. It was bad enough as it was. And as is always the case, a little goes a long way for our members. Rural got a little less than 5% of that total. Small urban's got another 5% of that total. But to a lot of them, that was 3 years worth of funding.
Right.
Locked in at 100% federal. Yeah, it was a godsend for sure.
Yeah. And looking at the ongoing funding picture, I mean, what do you see kind of large, from a macro scale and then kind of looking at a micro scale for your membership?
Well, at a macro scale, it's good to see that the appropriations committees here in DC are largely hewing to the bipartisan infrastructure law, the IIJA, and keeping those levels. Those levels represent significant growth. We certainly, like anybody else who's a transit advocate, felt better about what the Senate was doing than the House in this last round. But even the House bill for CTA's members, it grew 5307, it grew 5310, it grew 5311, it grew 5339, which to those listening, that's urban, rural, specialized, and dedicated bus capital.
Right.
Those are the key pots of funds. They grew. At a macro level, I still think we're just challenged by the notion that we are doing everything we can in the transit industry to lower our carbon footprints and to seek ways to provide zero and near zero emission operations, as we should. Yet our funding source remains tied to the sale of gasoline. And, you know, so at the macro level, when we talk about funding for public transportation, we've got to break that at some point. We've got to get the political will to change that equation. And there's lots of great ideas that have been thrown around. And sometime in my lifetime before I retire from here, that'll get changed because it's nonsensical where we are. At the micro level, the agencies largely would say, if I had all CTAA's 1,200 members standing behind me, we love the increases, but the additional costs of labor, the additional costs of energy, and the additional costs of capital have more than eaten up all of those increases, and we're largely treading water.
I guess you bring up one last point, and this is probably my last question for you, but obviously, the workforce shortage is a huge issue in the industry. Is it? I'm assuming it's hitting your membership as well. What are the kind of different things they're doing to kind of broaden the reach and get more people in the door?
Yeah, well, at the immediate level, it's like you've got to understand that there's competition, and again, the pandemic changed things. We've got a delivery-oriented economy. And so those vans and small trucks that you were used to seeing for chassis and vehicles, you're competing for those now with Amazon and UPS and FedEx and the drivers too. I think the best thing that the thing that we're pursuing in this area more than anything else is we want, and we've gotten some reasonably good feedback from Capitol Hill. We want a transit specific CDL.
Right.
The CDL is tied to the trucking industry because it was designed for over the road truckers and transit was kind of like a last second add-on 40 years ago. Well, we got hundreds of thousands of transit drivers around the country now, in not just in urban America, but everywhere. We think it's important that if we had a transit specific CDL, one, if you go and train a driver, you might not lose them to a delivery company. That's a different type of CDL. Just as important, we feel like there are things that our members are doing in that testing procedure that just don't make sense. Maybe they're keeping a vehicle in their fleet that they never operate in revenue service, but that's the one that the drivers have to get tested in. So, and does that make any sense that we're testing somebody for a commercial driver's license in a vehicle they'll never drive in revenue service?
Right.
No. So we're, you know, we're, and then at the very micro level, I think the idea is you, it's a competitive environment. You've got to look for drivers differently. You know, the whole process that was largely driven by HR, prior to the pandemic, now we need to be more aggressive. We need to be more flexible. We need to be, some of those long-standing transit practices of split shifts and the newest drivers in a bid process get the worst routes. We've got to look at these things and understand that for the longer term, you know, health of the industry, we've got to do that. And we've got to maintain and work on a safe working environment for drivers. The assaults on drivers that we read about happening in urban America, they're happening in smaller communities too.
Right.
We hear it from our members. So we've really got to come to a place where, look, that's that driver's office space. It's, I mean, it's a hard enough job just driving. To add all the other pieces into it, we've got to do what we can to make that a better job and a better career for people.
Right. Great. I appreciate your time. Great catching up with you again, Scott.
Hey, anytime, and it was good to see you. And it's also good to be talking to you outside of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And glad to have this time. Thank you.
For sure. Thank you.